Jeremy Corbyn's under pressure to give his MPs a free vote on airstrikes in Syria, despite not supporting military action against Islamic State himself. Tim Jones reports.
Jeremy Corbyn's made his position clear, but he's at odds with his deputy, Tom Watson.
David Cameron gave a compelling case in the Commons.
Mr Corbyn wrote to MPs explaining why he's against airstrikes. It's upset some, like Labour's Simon Danchuk.
Perplexing, to be quite honest. It's not what you call good, strong leadership.
The Labour leader faces a revolt from his top team, although Shadow Justice Secretary Lord Faulkner says...
I don't think there's any question of any resignations.
Mr Corbyn's allies are appealing for calm, but backbench critics are already talking about the Labour leader being forced to step down.
People of public prominence associated with Westminster will be investigated by the government's independent inquiry into child sexual abuse. Anglican and Catholic churches and a handful of local councils will also be examined. A man's been found guilty of conspiring to smuggle drugs into the UK using a fake ambulance kitted out with paramedic uniforms. Birmingham Crown Court heard that cocaine and heroin up to the value of £1.6 billion was brought across the channel. A man who beat his girlfriend before putting her body into a suitcase and throwing it into a canal in London has been jailed for life. Tomasz Kosik will serve at least 18 and a half years for the murder of Marta Ligman earlier this year. A memorial service has been held in Paris for the 130 people who died in terror attacks 2 weeks ago. A minute's silence was held in their memory and their names read out during the ceremony. That's the latest. I'm Victoria Lawrence.
Celebrating diversity, this is Bristol's BCFM 93.2.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Deputy Mayor and Conservative Councillor for Westbury-on-Trim, Jeff Gollop. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, Russian Su-24 supersonic bombers brought down by Turkish F-16s, violating airspace or a stab in the back. And British Parliament's in a dilemma, to bomb Syria or not to bomb. But which of the four sides will be beyond? And if the RAF get into dogfights with the Russian Air Force, who's going to shoot down whom? What about the longer game NATO are playing here? We've seen regime change in Afghanistan, Iraq and Libya, Syria soon perhaps. But then, what about Moscow? What about Beijing? Why not regime change there too? We hear evidence that's exactly what the Pentagon is getting ready for. Easy for them to dream of overthrowing Putin from the comfort far away in Washington. But will European leaders go along with it? One voice not on British television, John Pilger, looking at Syria too. Who's winning out in the war on terror? Plus Martin Summers' chance, if he wishes, to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 5 degrees, mainly dry with the occasional shower, so it makes it quite a mild evening really to go out for the BAM benefit gig at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just on the junction of Jamaica Street and Stokes Croft. That's 17 to 25 Jamaica Street. It goes on from 6:30 until 12. And the entry is £2 or a tin of food. That's the Bristol Housing Action benefit gig starting at 6:30 this evening. Then there's occasional showers later, though. Highs of 11 Celsius this weekend. A fairly wet and windy weekend. Next week, highs of 11, wetter and windier at the beginning of the week, and sunnier and cooler towards the end of the week. Next weekend, that's the 5th and the 6th of December, highs of 7 Celsius, fairly sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news, it's Deputy Mayor and Conservative Councillor for Westbury-on-Trim, Jeff Gollop. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony. Thank you.
Just remind us, Deputy Mayor, you're a sort of stand-in, are you, for George when he's not around?
No. I'm one of the assistant mayors.
And
I'm deputy mayor, and the only role of deputy mayor is to stand in if George is no longer with us.
Oh, really?
Effectively.
Oh, dear. Like a kind of vice president, hovering around behind the scenes.
Absolutely, yeah. So I've got a vested interest in making sure he's fit and well.
So how many assistants and how many deputies does George have?
So there are effectively four members of the cabinet, three assistant mayors and one deputy.
Okay, so who's the deputy? That's you, yeah?
So I'm the deputy.
And also an assistant. I'm getting a bit confused. Am I confusing myself here?
I am deputy mayor, and I also have a cabinet responsibility equivalent to an assistant mayor.
So what is your responsibility on the cabinet?
I am responsible for finance, budget, and what's called business change, which is the council's sort of internal service delivery and how it makes
things
work.
So who's in charge of the budget? Is it you, is it George, or is it KPMG?
It's definitely George, because George has all the executive authority. So he makes the decisions, he tables a budget, council debates it, but he is the one who ultimately has to approve it.
But doesn't he just spend most of his time kind of gadding around, jetting about, going to meetings, giving talks, while behind the scenes, people like you and KPMG, I know were involved certainly a couple of years ago in helping draw up the budget, don't those people and the council officers actually do most of the hard work?
The council officers certainly do a phenomenal amount of hard work, but the mayor's role is one of setting strategic direction, but also representing the city. So, to be honest, I know there's a lot of sniping about travelling and international presence, but if Bristol's going to be an international city, which I believe a city of this size should be, actually we've got to have a presence in the right places to help generate opportunities. And next week the mayor will be leading a delegation to the climate change conference in Paris and putting forward a view that cities have to play a major part in persuading governments to reduce the impact of climate change, and it's what we can do to make that work. Now, that's a really powerful message, because at the moment, central government hasn't necessarily been taking the action around the world to make this happen. And the message is very much that cities can influence that and actually be as powerful as central government.
Now, it must be a bit difficult to have a vision for the city, and I'm assuming you do have, you and George and the other members of the cabinet, when you're spending most of your time actually just making cuts. Do you not feel sometimes like you're sitting there as a kind of official receiver, saying, right, this has got to go, this has got to go, which one's going to go first?
There's an element where that is a challenge, but if I look back over the last 3 years, the majority of the reduction in spending that the City Council has made has been brought about by improving its efficiency and the way it does things.
Is that privatising? Is that what you mean?
There's an element of it has been privatising, but actually the majority of it is simply looking at what we do and recognising that, for example, who in their right mind would run an operation in one city from, I think it was 58 different office buildings? We did. We're now reducing that, so we'll have three main office buildings. Significant savings. So that's not cutting services to anybody. What that's doing is actually making the council work more efficiently. So there is an element where we can be very careful on how we spend the limited resources we've got, but there is an element where a lot of what we do is dictated by central government, and we're simply having to carry out what is laid down that we have to carry out. So you're right in the sense that there is limited amounts of discretion over what we can do, but we can give a message that Bristol is open for business and looking to encourage businesses to locate here and create opportunities for Bristolians.
Plenty of empty buildings, aren't there?
Absolutely.
Office buildings, which is not actually something to be proud of. I mean, actually there is space for businesses to move in here, so long as they're prepared to pay the artificially high rents, because that's what's going on, isn't it? I mean, any kind of market economy, which I'm assuming you as a Conservative would be into, those rents would start coming down, so those empty offices start filling up.
They should do. There's an element of the way the property market works that I have to say I'm I don't fully understand
the
logic.
Well, it's a ratchet. Jeff, it's a ratchet, isn't it? Rents only go up. They never come down. That's not a free market.
The supply and demand should influence the level of rents.
But it doesn't.
Part of the challenge is that some of the buildings that are empty now are of a quality that people are not wanting to rent, and that's presenting a challenge.
They're just a bit cheaper, then, aren't they?
We have a challenge as well that many of the office buildings are being converted into student accommodation, which is not providing housing for the people who need it and is not providing jobs for people in Bristol either.
Well, one of the reasons, I think, I mean, I've looked into this over the years, one of the reasons that rent doesn't seem to want to come down is when people are owners of big office buildings particularly, then they're valued on the rentable value of that mm-hmm. building. So as soon as rents start to come down, the value of the building then starts to come down, and that can make a company unviable. If they've got a big fixed asset mm-hmm. on their balance sheet, which is only worth three quarters of what it was last year, suddenly the bank is looking at it and saying, you're not a viable mm-hmm. business anymore.
Yeah.
So it's an accounting trick, something I would have hoped you would have. I mean, as an accountant, you know, let's get you on now on looking at the spending review and the mm-hmm. autumn statement
yep.
from the Chancellor. What can you help untangle about that? Because I was absolutely gobsmacked to hear that he's found this extra £27 billion out of nowhere, which he's going to use to stop the cutting of tax credits, which was going to be an appalling way to punish, really, people mm-hmm. who are low earners. And also he's managing to not do the police cuts that he thought he was going to have to. So mm-hmm. how has he managed to find this? Where has he dreamt this £27 billion out of?
Well, the fact is that a lot of this is forecasting and an estimation of what things are going to turn out. And my understanding is that as the economy is growing and proving to be more buoyant than was anticipated, the estimation of the tax take has been revised and has gone up. Now, I have an element of sympathy with the Chancellor, because when his tax take goes down, everybody blames him for not getting it right, and when he finds he's got some extra, everybody says it's a windfall and isn't he lucky. So I think one has to apply the same standards to both circumstances. But at the end of the day, it is an estimate based on what the Office for Budget Responsibility thinks is going to happen. So, to be honest, it's still going to be a question of waiting to see whether the tax takes come in at the level anticipated and the benefits expenditures are controlled.
Well, I'm going to make a little crystal ball prediction that Martin Summers is going to say he doesn't think they are. But anyway, before we hear from Martin, let's hear from the Chancellor himself from the Autumn Statement and the Spending Review, which I think only happens every 3 or 4 years. So it was both Autumn Statement and Spending Review on Wednesday.
And I've had representations that these changes to tax credits should be phased in. I've listened to the concerns, I hear and understand them, and because I've been able to announce today an improvement in the public finances, the simplest thing to do is not to phase these changes in, but to avoid them altogether. Yeah. Tax credits are being phased out anyway as we introduce universal credit.
Well, I think it's welcome that he's decided to scrap the tax credits fiasco from his own point of view. And John McDonnell, the Shadow Chancellor, said that if he did that, then the Labour Party wouldn't make political capital out of it, although he then tried to make political capital out of the change of direction. I think, as Jeff said, the Office of Budget Responsibility, which was set up by the coalition government last time to sort of create an independent assessment of what's going to happen, has decided that the economy looks better than it did. But they've not got a particularly good record of getting it right. And as Jeff said, it's basically a projection into the future which may or may not be correct.
Hasn't the Office of Budget Responsibility, OBR, which some people put independent in front of, and I really do put big inverted commas around that, since these are all civil servants employed by the government to go into this. Mm-hmm. What they've done so far is they've said, actually, we're going to be able to balance the books by such and such a time. It's like one of these cartoons where you see the same person kind of falling over a cliff three or four times, if you know what I mean. They're sort of pedalling in the air and they're standing there. But every time we hear this,
this, it's pushed back. Oh, we're going to balance the books in another year's time. It's not going to happen
yet. The fact is that George Osborne said he was going... I mean, of course, the national debt is still rising. We're talking about eliminating the deficit. The deficit was going to be eliminated in one parliament. It wasn't. Which was basically what Ed Balls, the then Shadow Chancellor, said. It wouldn't be one parliament. And in any case, to my mind, you shouldn't necessarily say that you're going to reduce a deficit in any particular timescale. It just depends on circumstances. So in many respects, George Osborne's backed himself into a corner by saying he's going to do things. It's only him who's saying that, and then he can't do them, so he then looks silly if he can't do them. I would suggest if I was Shadow Chancellor, I wouldn't box myself into that corner. I'd say, well, it's a judgment call, and we are going to try and reduce the deficit, but we can't actually say when or how rapidly that's going to take place. If there's a crash in China, all bets are off, and that's the real world we live in.
Before we hear again from Jeff Gollop, let's have another listen to George. It's taking us through some of the big figures. These are sometimes, I think, missed. How much of our money do these people we elect spend every year? I know here in Bristol, Jeff, I think I'm right in saying it's about £350, £400 million of our money that you spend at the City Council every year. And so what about the figures nationally?
This year, public spending will be £756 billion, then £773 billion next year, £787 billion the year after, then £801 billion before reaching £821 billion in 2019-20, the year we're forecast to eliminate the deficit and achieve the surplus. After that, the forecast public spending rises broadly in line with the growth of the economy and will be at £857 billion in 2020-2021.
Now, Jeff, it seems like public spending is going up at quite a rate, actually. We're talking there about £756 billion this year, rising up to £821 billion in just 2 or 3 years' time. So how is he going to balance the books if he's increasing public spending all the time? And how likely is it that he's really going to get massive extra tax receipts in?
Well, he's hypothecating it on the economy growing. And at the moment, the economy is growing. I'll tell you one thing that isn't growing, and that's the Bristol City Council budget. You quoted the figure from 3 or 4 years ago, and the net budget's down to about 280 million now. The gross budget is about £1 billion. But that isn't growing. But
what's the difference between the gross net and the gross? Just explain that.
So the net is what effectively is the income of the council from government, from business rates, and from council tax. So that's the net income. But then on top of that, we have all sorts of things like council tax rents. We have contribution to schools that are funded directly. We have revenue that comes in from parking charges, a whole host of different things that are income that the council generates to cover the costs that it has to pay.
I mean, there seems to be more and more in Britain, really, probably since the Tony Blair era, even maybe it goes as far back as Thatcherism, where more and more business expertise has been brought into government, and that that people are starting to run government like it's a business. Is that possible to do?
Well, you can't. Well, this is a personal view, but you can't run it like a business in the sense of purely measuring ultimately against a bottom line profit, for example. That's clearly not appropriate. But over the 15 years I've been involved in local government, the ability to measure performance in terms of what the costs are per resident for delivering certain services actually require comparison between local authorities to identify where there was gross inefficiency. So you can't necessarily run it as a business, because public service is a different animal. But what you can do is make sure that you are providing the services you do efficiently, and you measure the way you deliver them. So something the council hasn't been getting right but is aiming to improve significantly is things like answering phone calls at its customer service centre. The key part of how you deal with the people you're providing services to. If you don't actually answer the phone call because people can't get through, you are going to have mounting problems. If you actually show people you're listening to their problems and dealing with them, then you're getting a reaction. So it's actually those sorts of things where you do need to be businesslike and make sure you have the systems in place that work efficiently, so that you actually use the internet and technology to deal with the issues you can for the majority of your residents, so that you've got capacity in the system to deal with those who can't use a computer or those who've got very complex problems.
Well, now, most people contacting the council by phone, I'm sure, would rather have a human being pick up the phone and speak to them rather than have some sort of electronic voice saying, please press 1 or please press 2 and press 3. And then quite often those systems then just kick you out and you're left with a deadline.
I agree with you, but actually you're also, Tony, possibly showing your age, because actually there are a lot of the younger generation who all the surveys show would far happier go online and deal with the issue directly. And that is the shift. That's the way people are wanting to go.
But I mean,
now,
if you're phoning, you don't want to speak to a computer, do you? You maybe have tried online and you haven't got anywhere, so you need to speak to a human being.
Yeah, but we've been in the embarrassing situation that our residents have been using the website, finding it doesn't work, and then getting on the phone. So actually, what we've got to do is have the website that works, so they can use the technology to deal with the majority of their questions.
Anyway, Martin, back to these big figures, the $756 billion of our money that the government spending this year. Are we getting value for money out of Westminster?
Well, I mean, big figures sound big, and that's one of the things about them. And of course,
but they're going bigger and bigger, aren't they?
Well,
every year,
but, I mean,
they're up to 801, 821, and then up even further by 2020.
The derivatives market is, by some estimates, 10 times bigger than the world gross national product. By some estimates, 100 times bigger, and those numbers are enormous. And just bandying around enormous numbers doesn't help very much. You've got to know what they imply.
Well, what I don't understand here is, well, we've got to go through all this austerity and cuts. How come there's, you know, literally 40, 50 billion a year being added to the amount the government's public spending? How does he manage to work it all out?
The real problem is not that the goal is to reduce the level of the state as a percentage of gross national product to around 30%. Now, that's not been the case in this country since the 1940s. So if that is the goal which the Conservative government intends to pursue, and of course they're loading a lot of the pressure to achieve that goal onto local authorities, they are the Cinderellas in many respects, because the political calculation is, if local authorities don't deliver, the blame will not go to central government, it will go to local politicians like Jeff.
Jeff, do you sometimes feel like the fall guy for Westminster?
Very, very occasionally, but not most of the time, because actually, if you take Bristol, we've got a really positive story to tell about the way the city's going and what we're trying to do in terms of creating jobs and opportunities.
But doesn't it frustrate you that you're constantly having to deal with less and less central government money?
Which is why I'm very positive about Bristol pushing for devolved spending to get more of that money back to Bristol.
Well, you're going to have to get it from people around here, aren't you? Surely, I mean, we deserve our slice of the cake from the national pie.
We do, because of all the main cities in the UK, Bristol is, outside of London, Bristol is the only one that's a net contributor to the Exchequer. So actually, the Bristol belief is that we deserve to get some of that money back for us to invest, because we can make it work more effectively than central government can.
Well, this is another aspect of what the government's trying to do. Eventually, they're going to allow business rates to be kept within whatever the local area is, which generates those rates. Now, that, in fact, is ending the concept of the United Kingdom. You've got to redistribute, because in actual fact, you will then find that people who live in less prosperous areas of the country will find that they've got no resources. And there's always, the principle has been established since the 1940s that there should be redistribution between wealthier areas and less wealthy areas. And if we go down the road as being laid out by George Osborne, of more money coming to local areas and being held in local areas, that might be good for certain elements of the community in Bristol, but it'll be absolutely rubbish for people on the other side of the Severn Bridge in South Wales.
Martin in The Guardian yesterday, The Guardian's view on local councils, Osborne is creating a northern poorhouse. Apparently that's a clear calculation that cuts to local government services, would largely be blamed by voters on their councillors. As you effectively exactly what you're saying, Jeff, this isn't really fair on the north, is it? The north needs some support from the south, otherwise we're going to end up with a big sort of Watford gap, massive Watford gap, with poverty and an ex-industrial area that's going downhill.
I think we're reading too much into it at the moment. The idea of devolving business rates back to councils, 5 years ago, we didn't retain any of our business rate, but we had a rate support grant. Then the government had the idea that they would devolve to us 50% of our business rate. So we do now get 50% of the business rate, but the amount that that's reduced by has come off of the rate support grant. So actually we still receive the figure that they first thought of, it's just arrived at in a different way. So this whole argument about devolving business rate, we will ultimately end up with 100% of our business rate and no rate support grant, and ultimately that will be reflected across the country in different combinations, but there will continue to be a level of support, and I don't believe anyone is suggesting that support won't come from the more affluent areas to the boroughs.
I mean, I'm getting worried about these sort of ex-industrial cities like Sheffield, for example, that have large amounts of unemployment and haven't really managed to replace the business base that actually brought the city together in the first place.
That's right, but if you look at those northern cities, they're the ones who have all got public transport schemes with significant amounts of money funding those transport schemes. We are still struggling and just about to bring in a relatively modest metro bus operation compared to those public transport schemes. So both this government, the coalition and the Labour government have been funding transport projects in those northern cities, and that's going to continue.
One of the, I suppose, bright spots was, it was certainly, I mean, it'd be interesting to see what you two make of it, was the, it's actually a bit unfortunate because George Osborne was lumping prisons and housing together in the same little part of his speech. But anyway, let's have a listen now to, because this is something that comes up all the time on here, what are we going to do about the housing crisis? Well, apparently George has got some answers.
Old Victorian prisons in our cities that are not suitable for rehabilitating prisoners will be sold. This will also bring long-term savings and means we can spend over £1 billion in this Parliament building 9 modern new prisons. I am doubling the housing budget, doubling it to £2 billion a year. And we will deliver, with government help, 400,000 affordable new homes by the end of the decade. And affordable means not just affordable to rent, but affordable to buy as well. Yeah! That is the biggest house building programme by any government since the 1970s. Yeah! Almost half of them will be our starter homes, sold at 20% off market value to young first-time buyers. 135,000 will be our brand new Help to Buy shared ownership, which we announced today. We'll remove many of the restrictions on shared ownership, who can buy them, who can build them, and who they can be sold on to. The second part of our housing plan delivers on our manifesto commitment to extend the right to buy to housing association tenants. I can tell the House this starts with a new pilot, and from midnight tonight, tenants of 5 housing associations will be able to start the process of buying their own home.
The key word here is affordable. What does that mean? In actual fact, a substantial proportion of the population will never be able to afford to buy their own homes. But the tiny slice of the population that can afford to buy their own homes with government help are going to be given free money by the government. Other people are going to have to move out of their houses because they've got an extra bedroom because they're on disability benefit. But other key swing voters in certain marginal seats will be given 20% off the value of their houses by the government. That's money from me and you, which we're going to give to a certain proportion of the population. The proportion of the population that the Chancellor hopes votes will vote Tory.
I mean, that sounds like socialism to me, helping people get a foot on the housing ladder.
Well, what socialism is actually providing low-cost housing for people to rent, which is what... and it wasn't really socialism. I mean, Harold Macmillan, the Tory Prime Minister, was the one who built the most council houses since the war in Britain.
But George Osborne is building nearly 100,000 houses a year.
Well, he says
the highest number since the 1970s, and you're still complaining.
He says he's going to. The question is, will the private developers who he's relying on to do this deliver, which is a big question mark. And the other fact, I think forcing non-government organisations like housing associations to sell off their assets at a loss is completely reprehensible.
Well, they would say, actually, that what they've started to do is bring in the housing association budgets into the government budget, because these housing associations, there's been for years and years a kind of halfway house between private landlords and government, and the government are now saying, well, since we've funded so much of this house building over the last 30, 40 years, we're going to bring housing association debt within the government debt. So they've taken that on board as a government exercise.
Yeah, but I mean, the idea that existing tenants should be able to buy their properties at a loss to the organisation and a loss to society as a whole is simply reprehensible when we've got, as we know, in Bristol 14,000 people on the waiting list just to get any kind of housing, never mind buy their existing housing. It's to those that hath shall be given, and to those that hath not even the
little that they have
shall be taken away.
But the thing is, the price of housing, Martin, is so high. This is the only way, really, to bring it into, it seems to me, into people actually to get their foot on the housing ladder. Jeff, what do you make of this prisons and housing announcement?
Well, I mean, that for a start is a really positive proposal, because it's been very clear that the local prison hasn't been fit for the purpose it was being used for a good few years. So actually using that to help solve a housing problem by redeveloping it seems to me a really positive solution. But yeah, I sat here listening to Martin, and I can agree with one or two of the points that Martin expresses, but I think one's actually got to look at it, the fundamental issue. The housing market has not been working for a very, very long time. We have a ridiculous situation where we are having to subsidise housing associations, in particular, to build social housing. And then we're having to subsidise the rents by housing benefit to enable people to live in them. So actually, we've got to be realistic and look at this and say, what we've got isn't working. And I don't think that's a political point, actually, because it's been an amalgam of different parties' policies that have brought us there.
I'm going to interrupt you. Sorry, Jeff, because people's incomes just aren't enough to pay for rent.
Exactly. Hear me out there, because if we can build the extra houses mean there's more capacity, that actually will stop rents from going up. And therefore, providing the capacity in terms of more housing at the more affordable, use my words carefully there, end of the market, means that there is more opportunity to resolve this situation. But I come back to throwing money at those who build the houses and then throwing money at those who occupy them actually isn't the solution. We have to get the houses built, and then we have to get people into them as quickly as we're able.
If you don't throw money at them, the people aren't going to build those houses, are they?
No, so incentivising the builders to build those houses and make them more affordable will get the builders moving, and we'll get those houses into the market.
Now
we also need to look at the other end of the market, where provision for the elderly, because we have many people living in properties that are larger than they need, because they can't find anywhere else to move, and we have to create the opportunities where the people beyond a certain age can free up their housing stock by moving into more appropriate accommodation.
For a lot of people, they just simply cannot afford. They're homeless on the streets. Mm-hmm. They're squatting. Surely these people who are actually taking over buildings, I mean, we've got this benefit gig I was mentioning earlier on for Bristol Housing Action mm-hmm. tonight down at People's Republic for Stokes Croft. These people, what they're doing is, rather than... because they often don't have a deposit even to get anywhere mm-hmm. to live, they're saying, well, there's empty buildings. I mean, it's a criminal offence to squat a residential property. Yep. So they're finding buildings which are empty, which are non-residential. Aren't they entrepreneurs?
in one sense, they are entrepreneurs, because we actually have a real problem with fuel poverty and, if you like, housing poverty, in the sense that those who can least afford it are the ones that are being given very much the poorest service. And actually, we have to work very hard to improve that, because if money is being paid to agents to arrange accommodation and to landlords for below standard accommodation, then actually the tenants are not getting value for money, but they're actually frightened to complain, because otherwise they'll be out on the streets.
So I noticed on Points West this week, George Ferguson talking about finding council accommodation, or at least putting a bit of pressure from the council to make sure that empty buildings are opened up for the homeless in the city. Yep. It's been happening in Manchester, and Bristol's got plenty of property. It's not short mm-hmm. of land or buildings, mm-hmm. empty buildings.
Yep.
You think that's is that going to happen by Christmas? This is what he's saying, because I think it was really time to coincide with the real cold snap we had last weekend.
We've had a petition submitted to council advocating that, which I believe will be debated at council, and the mayor is committed to doing so. And to be honest, I think that might be an interesting way of also encouraging those who have got office blocks set around Bristol to weigh up how they want those office blocks used.
So meanwhile, next week, we're apparently bylaws being passed, which mean that council civil enforcement officers will be able to go around to the parks and force people who are having to sleep in tents in our parks to leave, or possibly face criminal prosecution. So, I mean, surely that is absolutely out of order, unless there's somewhere for people to go. Otherwise, all you're doing is you're trying to brush the homelessness problem under the carpet. I think we've got something like 5 or 6 parks now where regularly people are having to sleep in their tents because they've got nowhere to live.
Yeah, but just coming back to your point, we do have to find ways of providing accommodation to alleviate that situation, but it's also got to be done in a way that achieves something, and it's got to be supported housing. It is no good simply opening up a building but not putting the resources in to do it.
And well, I mean, if you want to give the building to the squatters, I'm sure they'll say, well, it's okay, we can paint this place up and we'll look after it.
Yeah.
Also, I think it was only fair to hear the other side, and this is, let's listen now to the Shadow Chancellor, John McDonnell, and he's replied to George Osborne, at least one part of it anyway. He's talking about what's going on with the international energy market, I suppose looking forward to the climate change conference this weekend.
Government ministers can go to the Paris summit on climate change with the proud record of nearly killing off our once flourishing solar renewable energy sector. This is no longer the family silver up for sale. This is the furniture, the fixtures and the fittings. And we know who's the first in line to buy. Can I just say, I never envisaged that when it came to nationalising, I would be outdone by a Conservative Chancellor. The only difference between us is that I would like to bring services like rail back into the ownership of the British people. The Chancellor wants to sell them to the People's Republic of China.
At which point he then waved this Mao's little red book around.
In the end, this debate is about what sort of society we want to live in. The government is systematically dismantling all those aspects of our society that make our community worth living in and celebrating. The Chancellor is not just cutting our services today, he's selling it off our future. But there is an alternative. And our alternative will be we will eliminate the deficit, but we'll do it fairly and effectively. We will do it by ensuring that we end the tax cuts to the rich. We tackle tax evasion and avoidance, and we invest to grow. And we will grow our economy on the basis of the investments in skills and infrastructure.
That was the Shadow Chancellor, John McDonnell. Just one thing I'd point out there, Jeff Gollop, from the Conservatives here in Bristol. Is the barracking, constant barracking from the Conservative benches, at least when Osborne was giving his speech. There were one or two sections where people were being very sceptical, but it wasn't quite so constant.
I think one side's as bad as another, to be honest. And I don't... It's not the way I would choose to do things, but... they're the ones in situ, and perhaps they have to break up the monotony occasionally.
Martin, it's a bit short on detail. He's saying things like you're going to eliminate the deficit more fairly, but he's not really going into where the money's going to come from, is he?
Well, it's a pig of a job being the Shadow Chancellor of whatever your political party, because the government of the day has done loads and loads of work on putting its budget or its statement together, and you get to look at it like 2 minutes before you go onto the pitch, as it were. So it's always going to be a difficult one, because you're left to just making broad brush statements, whereas all of these very detailed proposals.
Well, I mean, it's his opportunity to speak to the nation and give him a vision of what Labour would do, and he's just muffed it there.
Well, you may say that. I mean, what he's basically saying is all he can do in this is to try and elucidate the different philosophy of approach to the problems that are being discussed. So, for example, the obvious boilerplate he's coming out with there is we would not be cutting taxes for the wealthy. And I think, in actual fact, if we are all in it together, I don't see how it's conceivable for a Conservative Chancellor to suggest that the wealthy classes in this country have got any prospect of a tax cut until the deficit is reduced.
Well, some of the most vocal critics.
In actual fact, he's saying we're going to reduce the deficit and there's going to be a tax cut. That just doesn't stack up.
In a way, you're making my point for me there, because in The Observer, I noticed Will Hutton saying that everything we care for is being sold off, and the worst thing is that Labour's doing almost nothing about it. They're not really an articulate opposition.
Well, I mean, we've got a new leadership in the Labour Party, which is having a fairly bumpy ride.
Still bedding in.
Well, I mean, there's a problem. There's a tension between activists like myself and the people who sit in Parliament. And that is going to be, I think that's potentially
going
to boil over.
That's putting it mildly, isn't it? I think, isn't there a big rebellion going on at the moment with people actually talking about Jeremy Corbyn trying to do a coup over the Syria vote?
Well,
for
I mean, I think this. I mean, you know, this gives me no pleasure to say this, because obviously our Conservative opponents are very happy to see this kind of squabbling. But I'm afraid there's so much matters of principle at stake here. Many people who have come to senior positions in the Labour Party over the last 20 years are essentially sons and daughters of Tony Blair. And I'm afraid that most of the activist grassroots despise Tony Blair. And I'm afraid that we can beat about the bush as much as we like. But ultimately, there are two parties in one party trying to get out. And the same is true of other political parties, which is why I think we need to change the electoral system to allow everybody to have their say properly.
Well, talking about having your say, I spoke earlier this week, because we've been discussing this over the last few weeks, the St Paul's Carnival funding being pulled by George Ferguson and also by the Arts Council. Jeff, do you want to just bring us up to date with your thoughts about that? Because there are some very strong feelings amongst the Afro-Caribbean community that this is really micromanagement and they don't want it. They think they can run their own carnival perfectly well.
Well, it's a really difficult one to resolve, and I'll try and choose my words carefully, because the thing is that there is a sum of money allocated to fund the carnival, but the council believes that if it's providing that funding, that it should see something being delivered that reflects value for money for what is being put in.
Well, let's have a listen now.
And we have to recognise that, you know, that most of our communities around Bristol would love to have a small grant for some event within their area, and they don't get it. And the St Paul's Carnival is something so unique that it's really important that we cherish it and that it works. But it has to deliver.
Anyway, let's have a listen now to Cleo Lake, who thinks she can. She's Carnival Director. She thinks she can deliver. And so she'd take issue with you on that.
I think it's hard to separate the carnival, because it's African Caribbean and because of where it's come from. It's hard to... It's all part of the same jigsaw for me, because it's part of the journey. So when we know as well through Carnival that you know, it was about emancipation, it was about celebrating your culture, it was about freedom and all of those things that actually stemmed from enslavement.
But it almost seems like you're being micromanaged now by white men.
You know, I think ultimately, until the African Caribbean people can really unite and come together strongly and have a legal identity and challenge the city or whoever else to get more rights and maybe, you know, their own piece of land, I think we're always going to have problems, because our culture is to perhaps play our sound systems all through the night, but now our culture is too popular. And I think, and, you know, it draws such a crowd. And I think what also worries me is the fact that other people can come into the city who are probably more resourced than some people who've always been here and have worked from day one. It feels like sometimes we're being edged out of our own culture.
So, I mean, I feel a bit the same with the traveller culture here in Britain. Things like the Stonehenge Festival originally was a free festival. Yeah. Yes, it had a few safety problems, but it was a free festival, genuine event. And that's been now taken over, like Glastonbury, by, you know, the sort of event management people, great big steel fence all around it. That doesn't really wash with the British traveller culture. Neither does it with the Afro-Caribbean, does it?
No, and it, of course, will change the nature of the event.
Just finally, are we going to get Carnival 2016? And if so, what kind of shape will it look like?
Well, we have we've already had one community meeting, and we have another one coming up on Thursday, the 3rd of December, 6 o'clock at the Malcolm X, which everyone who supports Carnival and the organisation is welcome to attend. And that will really be about trying to recruit trustees. But even if that doesn't happen on the night, we will be working towards an AGM where we can get people on the board. We will be, you know, setting up steering groups where people with their, you know, they have their interest, their skill, will be put into a steering group. Can I also say that we will be jointly with Malcolm X Centre, which is also having its lease taken off of them by the council, although this is going to a legal battle. We will be joining the Malcolm X this Sunday, meeting at Malcolm X Centre from 11 a.m. to have a section in the March for Climate, Justice and Jobs, which leaves Castle Park at 12. So we're really appealing to not only the African Caribbean community, but also our friends to join us and to make it seen that we are a people, that we do have a voice, and that we do stand up. We will stand up, and that there are certain things that you simply cannot take away from us.
That's Cleo Lake there, and Cleo is a Carnival director. Jeff, this doesn't sit very comfortably, does it, with a former merchant venturer mayor, especially as that's the first I'd heard, and that interview is on our dialect show, which is dialectradio.co.uk, our sister show, which used to be on here on BCFM. That doesn't sit very comfortably, does it, with both the Malcolm X lease being taken away and the money funding for the St Paul's Carnival taken away?
First of all, I don't know anything about the lease, and I can't comment on that. But I have to say, as far as the rest of it is concerned, I don't think the mayor's background is relevant to this discussion. And actually, the point is that there is funding available, but the community is not being micromanaged. But on the other hand, the community has to deliver Carnival in a way that works in with the policing and safety requirements that both the council and the police believe are appropriate to ensure that that number of people can attend an event. So there has to be an element in which there is some overview of that, but only overview, not micromanaging.
Well, I mean,
but what we've got is the community hasn't delivered that Carnival. And we need the assurances that that Carnival can be delivered. And if it can be delivered, the funding, whether the mayor is assured, will be available.
Well, you can hear the full interview online at www.dialectradio.co.uk. Martin, what are your thoughts about Carnival briefly?
Well, I'm very much in favour of Carnival. I always enjoy it. I think the fact that a lot of people from outside the area come in could be regarded as a negative. I think it's quite positive, actually, and it would be a great shame if we were to lose it. But of course, it's got to be properly managed, and there's got to be accountability. Everybody's got to accept that.
Okay, let's have a look at some of the other stories this week. Binyan Ebrahimi was told to shut up and called a pain in police custody. Videos have been released of Binyan Ebrahimi's time in police custody just days before he was beaten and set alight by a vigilante neighbour who wrongly believed he was a paedophile. The 44-year-old Iranian had called police for help on July the 11th, 2013, after he alleged he'd been assaulted by his neighbour. Officers arrested him instead in front of an angry mob for breach of the peace before he was released the following day without charge. It just seemed as if the police actually were not actually investigating, just simply acting like a kind of mob, turning up and going along with what the majority of the people in the local area. And some definite tinges of racism here, Jeff.
Well, John, I think there's a real moral here to anyone who's involved in public service of any form, really, because there are always cases where someone is complaining about something and they keep on complaining, and the recipient of the complaint may think that they're going on too much. And this is a classic example where it was, you know, he probably was making a pain of himself because he was scared of what was going to happen. And unfortunately, the police didn't recognise the call for help. I think it's very difficult to judge, however, because I think others could have been in the same situation and made the same mistake. It doesn't make it right, and it does mean that we need to make sure we have procedures in place and the police have procedures in place for actually taking these things seriously. But they have limited resources, and I suspect that a view was taken that they divert those resources to other cases, and say it proved to be a wrong call.
I think the saddest thing about this is that I heard on the grapevine that after this chap had been burned to death, somebody had put some flowers on the place where he'd been burned to death, and other people came out and ripped the flowers up, which was a terrible indictment of whoever done that. And I think it's the message is quite simple. You are not to go around burning people to death, no matter what they've done.
Absolutely.
Under any circumstances, there is no justification for it. And the person who got 4 years here for supplying the white spirit, well, that's pretty lenient in the circumstances. What else are you going to do with white spirit apart from burn somebody to death? And he knew what it was going to be used for. And it's quite atrocious, really, that some people think that that's acceptable behaviour. It isn't.
Part of the defence review means that there's going to be 16,000 civilian redundancies by 2020. That will include a lot of people up at Filton too. But on to another story. Bristol Mayor scraps the troubled North Baths contract. That's in the Bristol Post this week. Multi-million pound deal to redevelop Bristol North Baths has been scrapped by Bristol's mayor 10 years after the site closed. George Ferguson, he has no faith in the developer's ability to save the scheme. Now, we seem to be having lots of these, Jeff, where developers come along and say, this is going to be wonderful, we're going to sort all this out. I'm thinking also of the enormous great rubble site in St Paul's where the old cardboard factory was, and the developers are just sitting on the land. Actually, they're not developers at all. They're property speculators, aren't they?
Well, this particular case of the Bristol North Baths wasn't a property speculator. It was a developer who, it appears, has not been able to get their act together. And that's the reason why the council has terminated the contract and is making arrangements to finish off what should have been a really important project that is now way over time and is not meeting the needs of the community.
Shouldn't the council just kept it open as a baths? Why on earth is it shut in the first place?
That was a decision taken by council, whatever it was, 5 years ago.
What a waste of our money.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was, in the sense that we have to make a decision about what we can afford, and it was, the baths were, it was an old set of baths. They were replaced by the new Hallfield pool, so there was a rational reason, because it was costly to maintain in the environment that it was in, and the new pool could be a managed more effectively on a more effective contract. So there's all sorts of reasons why for that, But this, but it begs the question of, should the council not have just simply disposed of the site and let someone develop it more quickly? The council chose this developer, and the developer has failed to deliver.
Young people will be poorer than their parents at every stage of life, the Institute for Fiscal Studies finds. This is not quite sure where I found this one, sorry. But anyway, it's by the journalist Zlata Rodinova. Young people will be poorer than their parents at every stage of life, including to an IFS report, evolution in households' wealth between 2006 and 2008 and 2010 to 2012, to find that young people today are more financially insecure than previous generations. Now, we've had David Cameron has been in charge since 2010. What are we doing to our young people, Jeff? This is totally unacceptable.
Well, you know, I think forecasts like this are not dissimilar to those massive forecasts of government tax take and the way the UK economy is going, because I'm not sure how anyone can identify how this comes about, and I need to know much more about the assumptions.
Isn't it
and
down
the way
to the same problem with housing? It's just not, people aren't being paid enough, are they?
Well, housing is certainly one of the key factors, and that may well present the challenge. But I am not convinced that one can still conclude from that that the people will be poorer at every stage. But I would make the point that I really don't believe that financial wealth is the sole thing we should be measuring by, because actually quality of life and all the other things that goes with it is something else that we have to measure. Well, I know that's another debate for another occasion.
It's disposable income. That gives you a little bit more freedom if you've got some disposable income. You've got more time, haven't you?
Yeah. Yeah.
Martin.
Well, I tend to agree with Jeff that, you know, projecting these things into the future is a mug's game, because who knows what's going to happen. I think that There is an element, though, where the political...
Sorry, Marcus, I want to interrupt you, because I've got another story here. This one from BuzzFeed, Laura Silver, where she's saying actually more young people are living in poverty than ever before right now. So it's not just about a future prediction.
Well, I think politically, part of the problem is that young people, we all know this, they don't actually go out and vote. And the political parties know this. And when they're making calculations about whether they're going to cut benefits for over 65s or further education colleges for under 25s, the political calculation is very clear. And it drives me to despair that something like 60% of under 25s said that they were not going to vote at the last election. Extraordinary. And if you are setting out in life without assets behind you, you need your political clout. You need to demand that your needs are met and recognised. But unfortunately, we've developed a kind of culture where political parties, whatever their parties are, they know that the over 65s overwhelmingly will vote and that the under 25s won't. And that's the result is what we see.
Thank you, Martin. Time now for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to this week's guest, Deputy Mayor and Conservative Councillor for Westbury on Trim, Jeff Gollop. Russian Su-24 supersonic bombers brought down by Turkish F-16s, violating airspace, or a stab in the back. We discuss that after the 6 o'clock news from Rupert Murdoch.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre. From the